Okay, thank you, Andrea. So it's great to be here. I've been learning a lot from different communities, including my own. So this talk is supposed to be very accessible and understandable. The experts in the room have already seen some variants of this talk, perhaps several. So please feel free to stop me if you have questions about anything. So we'll be looking at this problem of estimation in statistics. So we have observation pairs xi, yi, and we're trying to use them to figure out how to estimate the unknown parameter vector beta star. Since it's a statistics talk, we'll use beta. And we're going to be looking at the setting of m-estimators, which have been sort of mentioned in a few talks previously, but let's just review. So an m-estimator is, well, you can think about this as, if you want, empirical risk minimization. So we have a loss function, and we apply it to each of our observations, and we want to minimize the average of this loss function applied to these different IID observations. So this is what we would be doing in low dimensions. When we move to high dimensions, when the number of parameters is much larger than the number of observations, then we need to use regularization. And so this is the formulation we'll be looking at, where L is the loss function and rho is the regularizer. There will also be a parameter lambda. So if we were looking at L1 penalization, then we would be taking lambda times the L1 penalty of beta, for instance. So as an example, imagine that we're looking at linear regression. Then if we were in low dimensions, what we might do is just do an ordinary least squares fit. And then that would give us the usual formula for the best fit line. And in matrix form, it's x transpose x inverse x transpose y. But the problem is that in high dimensions, there are actually going to be many solutions to minimizing this sum of the squared errors. And so in order for the solution to be identifiable, we need to assume some kind of structure on the underlying parameter vector. And what we assume is sparsity. And so if we assume that our unknown vector is sparse, then a penalty that we might put on this least squares objective is an L1 penalty to encourage sparsity. Another way of seeing why a penalty is necessary is that if you simply look at this formula, then this matrix here, which would be x transpose x over n in matrix form, is not going to be invertible once the dimensionality exceeds number of observations. And the way of seeing that is that each of these vectors, x, so these are the high dimensional vectors, all right? We're looking at x times x transpose, so that's going to be a giant p by p matrix, where p is the very large parameter. P is the dimensionality parameter. And that's a very large rank 1 matrix. So then we take n of them, because our empirical risk is the sum of n things, right? So we sum up n rank 1 matrices, and the overall rank of this sum is going to be at most n. But our dimensionality is p, which is very, very big. So that's why this matrix here is not invertible. So we wouldn't be able to just plug it in and figure out what the solution is. This problem here is the lasso that's nice and convex, but of course this talk is about non-convexity. So the first thing I want to motivate is why I actually care about non-convexity. I want to say we, but I think we care about non-convexity for all sorts of different reasons. So my work has been motivated by various statistical settings in which there is potential non-convexity that arises in both the loss function and the regularizer in this problem. And I'm going to just say a little bit about some of these situations where this has come up. The overall theme is that certain types of non-convex problems are very hard, certain types are easy, right? And so I'm trying to give examples of some of the non-convex losses that are easy in the sense that I say it's easy because my theory applies to these things. So keep that in mind. So no, the types of conditions I impose will not be applicable directly to neural networks, but they will be applicable to these types of problems. Okay, so I said on the previous slide, non-convex loss could be used to correct some sort of noise or errors. So what does that mean? There's this problem that's in classical statistics known as the errors and variables model, or the measurement error model. And basically, what you have is you have these pairs x, I, y, I, but you don't know what x is. So instead, you observe some noisy version of x. And so you have some noisy surrogate of x, and then you observe the response y that corresponds not to that noisy version z that I put in, but the actual version x that I didn't see. And z will be related to x via some noise model. So it could be, yeah.
The I is indexing
the observation. So we have n observations. Yeah.
And the beta is a matrix.
Beta is a vector. It's a p-dimensional vector. So there is some kind of a regression vector that we're trying to estimate.
Okay.
All right. So x is p-dimensional. Y is scalar. So we're going from a p-dimensional space to a scalar.
Okay.
So like a neural network, right? You get out your scalar prediction. Well, okay, that maybe not always in a neural network you get a scalar prediction. I take that back. Okay. So we want to estimate the unknown regression vector beta star from these noisy observations. Okay, so one thing that you could do is you could just say, well, I will fit least squares anyway. Maybe to make things a bit simpler, like imagine we're just in low dimensions and there's no L1 penalty, and you just fit least squares. Well, it's not too hard to see that this will give you a biased solution. And so why is it biased? Well, because for every one of these measurement vectors, you have a little bit of noise. If you go back to the formula, yeah.
Uh-huh. What are the z's?
Now, the z's are a noisy version of the x's. So the x's were a p-dimensional vector, and now we're getting a noisy version of the p-dimensional vector. So by noisy, it could mean that every component has some independent additive noise added to it. It could mean that some of the entries are zero because they just were censored or missing or something like that. So in the linear model, if you go back to the linear model, standard linear model, right, there is already noise.
Yeah.
So there's noise in relating the x to the y. And now we're putting more noise on top of that. So the noise that relates the x to the y, this is noise that can be tolerated if we were to do least squares or run a lasso. Right? But if we were to add extra noise on top of this, so in addition to corrupting the x as it produces y, we corrupt the x to z, which is what we observe. Right?
But you're observing the y.
Yeah, we're observing the x's and the y's. So it's like regression. Right? You observe, if you're looking at regression, you observe the x's and the y's. Yeah, so you observe both the x's and the y's, and here, yeah. Right. So that's why it's errors in variables, or I guess errors in predictors.
Another way to think about this, I'm just trying to understand, would mm-hmm. be just the same that the epsilon i's are no longer independent of the x's?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you have independent additive error, so zi is xi plus wi, then you could write it as a regression where it's yi equals zi transpose beta star plus epsilon prime.
Right.
But the problem is that the epsilon prime is not going to be independent of the z's anymore. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So that will mess up the consistency of your least squares. So another way to see that just regressing y on z isn't going to be that good is that, I mean, you can think about the solution to least squares. It's like x transpose x inverse x transpose y, right? And this is sort of relevant to the arguments I'll give in a bit. X transpose x it converges to the covariance matrix of the x's, at least in low dimensions. And this converges to the covariance between the x's and the y's. Okay, so now imagine that that x is corrupted by some noise, so you get z instead. So if you plug in z here, then what you get is sigma z. You get the covariance of z. But what you wanted in here was the covariance of x, right? And similarly here, you have the covariance between z and y. So it turns out that the covariance between z and y in expectation is the same as the covariance between x and y, so that's not an issue. But at least for this term, you're going to have a problem, right? So it's going to be biased even in low dimensions. And so, putting an L1 penalty certainly won't solve any of your problems if in low dimensions you're converting to the wrong thing. Okay, so, but exactly what I said back here sort of motivates what we did, which is that, well, you can say, let's pretend I just put in z, all right? Then it would be sort of right. I mean, it would be almost right. So if I knew what kind of noise I was adding, so if I knew the noise covariance, the variance of my noise, then I could figure out how to correct this term, right? So if I put in z, it would be an estimate of sigma z, but I don't want sigma z, I want sigma x. And how is sigma x related to sigma z? Well, if it's additive noise, then the variance of z is the variance of x plus the variance of your noise, right? So what you do instead is you plug in some surrogate. So you start with plugging in z, and then you subtract off what you should have corrected for. And similarly, if we needed to correct this, which it turns out we don't, we would just correct that term. Okay,
but you assume that you know the covariance of the norm.
Yeah. So that's one deficiency of this work, which is that we need some way of estimating or knowing what this covariance is. On the other hand, I mean, even in the traditional errors in variables setting in statistics, oftentimes the assumption is that you have some estimate of your noise. And this is perhaps a little bit more realistic. Or somewhat realistic, because your noise is, it's the noise on the x's, right? It's like something that you can tell by calibrating your machine. Every time I set it at this particular acquisition level, I got an acquisition at this level instead. Whereas something like knowing something about your noise, epsilon, would be a little bit more far-fetched. Because if you want to know something, like there are two sources of noise, right? There's the noise in the x's and then the noise that's producing the y's. And it's maybe more reasonable to assume that you know something about the noise in the x's rather than knowing something about the noise in the y's, because this is inherently related to whatever your predictor, whatever your estimated beta is. So what I said is sort of almost right, which is that we want to plug in the z's directly and then do some correction. However, remember that our interest is not so much in this low-dimensional problem but in the high-dimensional problem. Yeah, question. Right.
How do you expect that to affect the problem versus if you fixed the statement of the problem and then?
Yeah, well, so I would answer that in two ways. The first is that the way that we're measuring a good fit is we're looking at something like L2 or L1 error. And so you can measure this whether or not your problem size is growing. Another way of answering this is that we assume some sort of underlying structure. And generally, in order for these estimation guarantees to work, you need this this true structure that you don't know where the support is. You need that number of true non-zero values to be somewhat smaller than the number of observations. So going back to how would we correct this? Well, I told you how to correct it in low dimensions. In high dimensions, it's sort of the same idea. So you can imagine taking this this objective function and expanding it out. All right, so if you expanded it out, you would end up with some kind of quadratic in beta, and then the penalty term. And so for the quadratic in beta term, So for the quadratic in beta term, the cross term would be x transpose x. Right, the cross term would be exactly this thing. So then we correct that. Did I say cross term? The Hessian term would be this term. The cross term from the square would be xi times yi. Right. So the idea is just to expand out the subjective and replace the parts that depend on x with something that doesn't depend on x. So we had a general proposition proposal for this, and the general proposal was exactly what I said. So imagine you're doing that you're doing some kind of penalized least squares. So you had this sum of the squared errors, which I've now written out in this quadratic. And I dropped the constant term because it doesn't matter when I'm optimizing over beta, and I kept the penalty. And the proposal is just to come up with the appropriate surrogate that replaces each of these terms that depended on x. So one example is what I was sort of sketching out earlier, which is that if we have some additive noise, some independent additive noise, then the right thing that we should use to replace the Hessian term is the estimate of the covariance of z minus the covariance of w, which we either know or we estimate. You can also imagine doing this when you have some kind of missing data, like I sort of alluded to, where maybe some fraction of your entries are independently zero or something like this. So that seems great, but then here's where the non-convexity enters. So right off the bat, it turns out that this problem, even if you had an L1 penalty, would end up being non-convex in high dimensions. So the reason for that is that if we were in low dimensions, it would be nice and convex and there would be no problem. Okay, so in low dimensions, you would say, well, z transpose z over n is a sample covariance for the covariance of z. It converges, you know, with rates that we can control to the covariance of z, and that's nice in PSD. The covariance of z is the sum of the covariance of x and the covariance of w. So if I subtract the covariance of w, it's still the covariance of x, which is nice and positive definite, so there's no problem. Okay, but in high dimensions, we go back to the problem that this sample covariance matrix, which looks much like the sample covariance matrix here, except we have z's, right? This is now going to be a low rank matrix because, again, it's sitting in this high dimensional p by p, p by p matrix space, and it has rank at most n. Okay, so that's not.
So is it clear that it's also not like restrictively strong convex?
So it ends up being restrictively strong convex, which is why all this stuff works out. Exactly. Yes. So I'll get there. Right. So this matrix in itself, if I just had z transpose z over n, no problem. It's still a convex problem. But I needed the correction in order to make it sort of statistically consistent and unbiased. So I needed to subtract this positive definite thing. And once I take a low rank PSD matrix and I subtract a positive definite correction, then I have negative eigenvalues, and then the whole problem overall is not convex. Okay? And then, of course, adding an L1 penalty is not going to help. If I added a ridge penalty or something, then I could try to boost up the eigenvalues. But at least looking at an L1 penalty, which is what we want to do to encourage sparsity, is not going to make this problem convex. Okay, and now the nice part is that we can prove that, in fact, the landscape of this problem is not that bad. And I mean, the reason is that this problem is not that bad, right? So it's a non-convex problem. I just told you why it's non-convex, but it's not convex. It's not non-convex in disastrous ways. All right, so that is a motivation for looking at a non-convex part of the loss. So remember, we have a loss and we have a regularizer, and I'm going
to
play with both of them. Yeah. Yes. Yes. But in expectation, it is the right thing. Yeah, so this is the thing. So if I had infinite data, if P were not high dimensional, right? So there are different types of methods that you could use to come up with some kind of convex surrogate for this problem, right? And there are methods that would, in fact, give you a convex problem where the global optimum has good properties. But sort of the purpose of this theory that I'm sketching out is to say that even though we come up with sort of a natural type of non-convex problem, then the landscape is something that has nice properties. Right.
So
is there another question?
Projections, yeah. What is this Coco lasso?
Coco lasso? It might be. Yeah.
Basically, I think the same as you guys, but then they project on the case.
Right. Yeah, I think this is Hui Zhou from Minnesota. I think this is Hui Zhou from Minnesota. I can't quite remember, though. Yeah.
I guess it's sort of the same. Mm-hmm. I can't understand why is this gamma hat the right thing to do in the high-dimensional regime? Because it's not so. What he says, you can come with a convex surrogate.
Yeah.
But forget convex surrogate. I'm just, even without being bounded by convexity.
Uh-huh.
I mean, this gamma hat, it's not. I mean, it's not the maximum likelihood estimator.
Mm-hmm. The maximum likelihood estimator is way uglier.
Right.
Yeah.
So
and very non-convex.
No, because
yeah.
It would. I mean, without the W's, would be right, but or close to it, would be almost the same.
Yeah.
So it's not the maximum likelihood estimator.
Yeah, it's not at all.
It's just why is this at all the right thing? Like, why shouldn't I even just something simple like just cut off the negative, remove the negative components from it?
Right. Well, removing the negative components is not going to be consistent. Yeah. Removing the negative components is not going to be consistent. But if you
is not going to be consistent.
Yeah.
Consistent, or the resulting beta is not going to be consistent.
The resulting beta.
Okay.
Yeah. So I mean, maybe saying it's the right thing to do is not the right word, but like it is a thing that seemed natural to me, and it works, right? And this sort of general principle of replacing these things by unbiased things. Is something that seems natural. It's something one could do, and it works. Yeah. Okay. All right. So we have a loss part, and then we have a regularizer part. And now I'm going to say a little bit about why we might care about non-convex regularizers as well. All right. So why do we use an L1 regularizer in the first place? Well, one explanation that people often have is that really, you want a regularizer that counts the number of non-zeros, and that would be like an L0 norm. But if you look at an L0 norm, which is not a norm, of course, then the shape of this L0 function is that it should be 0 and then 1. So if the component is a 0, I don't count it. If the component is non-zero, then I count it as a 1, right? But then it's not convex, and so people say, like, well, let's look at L1 instead. Right. But then these two penalties are sort of different if you think about it. And the main difference is that L1 continues to grow if the component is very large in magnitude. And maybe if you're just trying to penalize for solutions that have a lot of non-zeros, then you want to have a count whenever the value is non-zero, but not a bigger count when it's much bigger. All right, so there have been different families of regularizers that have been proposed in the statistics literature. And these regularizers are kind of interpolating, or they're halfway between an L1 penalty and something like L0. So for reasons that are good for optimization, many of them, and they start at zero with some kind of L1-like slope. And then after a while, they curve off, and then they become constant. And the regularizers that are most famous in this family are called the SCAD, or smooth clipped absolute deviation penalty, and the MCP penalty, which is sort of a cousin. And the shape is that it's L1, and then it's quadratic, negative quadratic, and then until it becomes derivative zero, and then it becomes constant. So that's the clipping. So the clipped or capped L1 penalty would not have the smooth part. So it would be just L1, and then it sharply goes off to constant. But the SCAD penalty, the green one, is L1, and then negative quadratic, and then constant. All right. So it was known for some time. I think the SCAD penalty came out in 2001. It was known for some time that using least squares with something like this SCAD penalty led to better, more accurate solutions than simply using a lasso. All right, so this is just a plot from a survey paper saying that it seems to work better. So it's comparing the lasso as the baseline with other types of non-convex penalties. Yeah. So MCP is called a minimum concave penalty. And so it has a similar type of behavior. It just has different points at which the kinks happen. Right. OK, so it was sort of known or not really understood, but kind of accepted that these penalties seem to be working better. But then, of course, the gap in the theory, which I think is here, is that it wasn't really known how the landscape of these functions look. Because, so just to reiterate, what are we doing? We're looking at something like least squares. So imagine this is not here, and it's just a nice convex least squares part. And then instead of L1, we put a SCAD penalty, then suddenly we have a non-convex problem all over again. Right, and so one question you might ask is, well, how do you even plot these things, right? So how does one know that one finds a global optimum, or are these local optima, or what's going on? And it was generally not really very well understood. It seemed like local optima were well behaved, but there wasn't any kind of guarantee on this. Okay. So our main contribution, our first main contribution in this area, was to say that the landscape of these functions looks sort of like this, right? And so what I mean by sort of like this is that the local optima are all going to be kind of close to the global optimum. So maybe let me emphasize one thing, which is that there are three betas going on here. So one is the true beta star. And so as a statistician, what you want to do is you want to estimate that true beta star. Okay, then there is a global optimum, and that's what we write as beta hat. And beta hat is going to be close to beta star, which is something that we could prove. And there was also some preliminary evidence for in the stats theory before our work. But then there are also local optima, and they're going to be somewhat, you know, they could be in other parts of the function. Now, as an optimization theorist, you would probably really care about beta hat, right? So you want to find that global optimum. But as a statistician, you really want to find beta star, so beta hat is good enough if you can prove that it's somewhat close. And if we can prove, which we did, that the local optima, beta tilde, are also are equally close to beta star, then this is very good, right? Because we don't really care about beta hat if beta tilde is as close to beta star as beta hat was. So the way that so to make things a bit more rigorous, we show that the rate of convergence of any local optimum to beta star is on the same order as the rate of convergence that the global optimum would be. And furthermore, this is sort of the optimal rate that you would get if you ran something like a lasso, or let's say if in the errors and variable setting you ran a lasso where you actually did observe the excess. Okay, so this is sort of the best thing that you could hope for. All right, so this is just kind of a short slide saying that there are different types of ways in which we could measure closeness. And we have various work that covers each of these types of closeness. So one is the L1 or L2 or L infinity error between a local or global optimum and the true beta star. And then another type of closeness that we studied in another work that took some more work was to say that the solutions, both the global and the local optima, are variable selection consistent. And so variable selection consistency means that if you look at your estimate, so you can prove that the estimate that you get will have a small number of non-zeros, and furthermore that those non-zeros will match up with the true non-zeros of beta star. Okay. Right, so I'm sort of running out of time, so maybe let me just kind of give some high-level things. So of course we need some conditions to hold, right? So our theory does not only hold for the errors and variables setting that I mentioned earlier. It holds in somewhat more generality, and abstractly we have various conditions on both the loss and the regularizer under which this picture holds. This picture being that picture. And as Ankur pointed out, essentially the type of the condition that we need on the loss is something that's called restricted strong convexity. We also need a condition on the regularizer, which is basically that it's not too non-convex. All right. So the nice thing about these regularizers that I mentioned earlier is that they're sort of L1, and then they're negatively curving quadratic, and then they level off, which means that if you look at the second derivative, it's not going to be too negative. Okay. So let me skip some of these things. So I wanted to give this picture because I think it provides some nice intuition for this. So this picture here is showing the difference between the true population level loss and the objective that we're trying to optimize, the non-convex objective. All right. So you can think about this. Earlier I wrote this would really be L plus rho. So this is like if I'm doing linear regression plus the SCAD penalty, I need to sum up both of those things. But basically, if I were to take n to infinity, or just like take the expectation of each of these components, then the overall function would be nice and convex. So if we go back to the picture of, or not the picture, but if you go back to this equation, right? So if I just send n to infinity, then this becomes a nice convex problem. So the point is that this function in itself is not convex, as we have discussed, but sort of the limit of it is. So the picture that we have is that we have so we have this picture here, and then because of finite samples, because we're not actually sending n to infinity, and it's a high-dimensional problem, we have a non-convex problem. Okay, but then the insight is, well, in this picture, the local optima are sort of far away from beta star, so that's bad. So what are some conditions that we might impose so that local optima are well behaved? Well, it turns out that the right way to look at it, or one way to analyze it, is from the point of view of the gradient. So if we look at the gradient of the function, so our nice convex problem at the population level has a unique global optimizer, which is beta star. If we look at the derivative of this, then that nice convex function will be monotonically increasing and cross the origin at exactly one point. And now you can imagine looking at some empirical version. So just like how the empirical version, the finite sample version of the loss, is wiggly, the finite sample version of the gradient is also going to be wiggly. And it might cross the axis at multiple points corresponding to multiple local optima, right? But if we have some control over what the gradient looks like, or basically saying that the gradient is well-behaved, so closeness in gradient means closeness in these betas, then that can guarantee that any of these crossing points, any of these local optima, are still going to be close to beta star. All right? So that's kind of the insight, that what we want to do is we want to operate at the gradient level. So that's the basic. And if we were to look at what the integral of this looks like, then we would find a function that where the wiggly one just has wiggles close to beta star and not further up. Okay, so let me skip through the details. So maybe just one thing. So this notion of restricted strong convexity, the condition that we need to impose, it had previously been imposed only for convex functions. And what we did was we extended this notion to functions that could have some amount of non-convexity. And we showed that if a function satisfies this condition up here, then the type of guarantee we're looking for holds. And furthermore, that the problems that we're interested in, like this measurement error problem or this non-convex penalty problem, will in fact fall into this category. All right, so let's just skip through that. So the first key insight, and the second one will be very fast, I promise. So the first key insight is that convexity of the red curve, so convexity of the population level objective, or if you want, the objective that you get when you have infinite data, if that is convex, then at least according to the analysis that we have, can guarantee for you a tractable landscape of local optima for finite samples. So this kind of relates back to what I said, that if we have, well, why did I think of this objective in the first place? Well, it was kind of this wiggly approximation to the population level version. Okay. So the other thing I wanted to say, so since this work, I've gone in the direction of robust statistics, and now I'm going to relate that to this and say how it gives us some extra insights. Okay, so what is robust statistics? Well, robust statistics is basically a subfield of statistics that tells you what should you do when you have outliers. Okay, so if you have a bunch of points which are mostly on a line, and then you have some points that are further out, and you fit a least squares line, you end up with a line that's sort of halfway in between. However, there are different types of loss functions that give you better behavior. And some of the key figures in robust statistics were Huber and Tukey. So you may have heard of a Huber loss. A Huber loss is quadratic and then becomes linear. So it doesn't grow as quickly as a quadratic. And a Huber loss that corresponds to the red curve, and that already gives us a better fit. And then there are other types of losses that are actually non-convex. So here enters, again, the non-convexity. Something like the Tukey biweight function. So the Tukey function is non-convex, and you see that in this particular example, it gives us an even better fit. And so this is now another reason for looking at non-convex losses. And now let me also emphasize that the difference between doing some sort of fit with something like least squares loss versus something like a Tukey loss is that even if we had infinitely much data, even if we sent n to infinity, it would still be a non-convex problem. All right, so it's not going to be the picture that I put earlier here, where we have this red curve that's nice and convex. Instead, we're going to have a red curve that is maybe nicely behaved around the true optimum, but then is not very nicely behaved. And that means that if we draw this picture, we'll end up with wiggles all over the place. So this, the type of theory that I said earlier is not going to quite apply. Okay. So the nice thing is that it sort of it locally applies. All right. So. So I'm going to skip through that too. So just to reiterate, now we're going to re-examine this sort of problem where we have a regularizer, and I've simplified it to L1, but you can think about some non-convex regularizer as well. And we have a loss function that is now going to be non-convex. All right, so non-convex in the sense of, you know, maybe it's non-convex like a Tukey loss, and even if we send n to infinity, the non-convexity is not going away. Okay, so population level non-convexity is no longer satisfied. All right, and the basic conclusion is just that that we have a type of behavior that maybe looks a bit like a picture from Rhea's talk earlier, which is that there's a region in which local optima are well behaved. Okay, so maybe this is not too surprising. So the picture I was drawing out is we had our red curve, it's no longer nice and convex, but now it's convex sort of locally, and then it's not convex. So maybe the best we could hope for is that there's a landscape where we can now say something about local optima that are kind of close to the global optimum, and then other ones we might not be too sure about, right? And that's exactly what happens. But then the other important thing is that we can actually provably find these good local optima. Okay, so the main contributions here are that there is a way of doing proper initialization. And maybe the short story is that the way of doing proper initialization is to use some kind of some other function that we're going to optimize, maybe a convex surrogate, if you will. And what is the convex surrogate that you want to use? Well, remember that we are trying to do something that is robust. So we want to do some sort of robust regression. Where's my picture of robust regression, right? We have some outliers, and if we want to make things more robust, then you can show theoretically that that using a Huber loss is going to be a better thing to do than using a quadratic loss. So a Huber loss dampens the effect of outliers. So the proposal, which you can show theoretically actually works, is that instead of optimizing this nasty function for which you might find a local optima that's far out, what you do instead is you first look at a robust loss, like a Huber loss, which is convex, with an L1 penalty. You find the global optimum of that. that will provably find you a solution that's inside this good region, this good basin of attraction. And then provably, using some kind of iterative gradient descent-like algorithm, will keep you inside that basin of attraction and find you a good local optimum. So I'm not saying it will find you the global optimum, because inside this good basin of attraction, there still might be more local optima, but it will find you a good solution. Okay, so that's the basic idea. So let me just fast forward to my concluding insights. So my insight were, so in addition to the fact that that convexity of a population level loss gives you this nice shape where all the local optima are well behaved, I was able to extend this to a setting where the population level objective might not be convex, because maybe you want things to be more robust and you need to do something to handle the outliers. And for that reason, you might only be able to look at conditions, at a family of loss functions that are locally well-behaved. All right? But using the same types of theory, you can then show that the finite sample version is locally well-behaved. And furthermore, the last important thing is to find a good initialization. And I think this is maybe something that we see a little bit in some of these other talks throughout the workshop, which is that you can find a good initialization through various methods. In this case, it turns out that using some convex method will work. Okay, so thanks for your attention.
Questions?
Perhaps I have one question. So in the case, for instance, of the robust regression,
yeah,
actually we had this paper with Song in which we had global convergence without initialization. So I don't remember anymore.
I guess it must be different losses then, because with these non-convex losses, you can definitely find local optima that are far away.
It's for the same losses. I mean, it's for 2k.
For 2k.
I think it applies to 2k, right?
But you're guaranteeing that all the local, no, isn't it just certain local optima will be very close?
No, all the You take an L2 ball that is, you know, any large constant times the real parameter vector, and you do gradient descent.
Okay, well, we should discuss more,
and
because I think in my simulations I found some local optima further. Maybe the ball is larger than, maybe your ball is smaller than what I said.
And actually, there is only one global optimum.
Yeah, that one, I believe, yes. Yeah.
Any other? Okay, if not, we can.
Okay, thank you.